Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple. Networking and relationship building, it is just not the same virtually as it is in person. And we're going to be in this hybrid world for a while now. Those relationships really matter because they are crucial for our productivity in our current job. They are crucial for finding our next job. Kimberly B. Cummings is the author of Next Move, Best Move, Transitioning into a Career You'll Love. Kimberly's here with tips on how to navigate these times, then affording your retirement life. We talk all the time about saving, but how do you ensure you spend in a way that is sustainable? You know, like that your investment portfolio is going to be enough to last. Saum Seif is the founder and CEO of Purpose Investments, and he's going to join us to talk about the Longevity Pension Fund, plus a Canadian fintech that lets customers pay their bills and invoices by text, email, even QR code. It is called Click to Pay, and its CEO and founder, Michael Bradley, will share with us how it works. Plus, cryptocurrency. I mean, we've been talking about it a ton. A part of me rolls my eyes with yet another crypto innovation, and a part of me is all bright-eyed and interested about another crypto innovation. Mikel Castellago from RateHub.ca is here to tell us all we need to know about the latest in crypto. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. Accumulation, saving for retirement is the phrase. Oh, that's not even a phrase. Oh my God, I can't believe I made that mistake. Here we go. Accumulation, saving for retirement. This is the word we seem to talk about endlessly. Less time is spent on decumulation, using those savings to pay for life once you're no longer earning a paycheck. It can be a pretty complex process, right? Like which bucket of savings, when am I taking the money out? How much am I taking out? It was so much easier when those rare few had a defined benefit pension plan, but most people don't these days, right? Purpose Investments has launched an income for life mutual fund to try and help, tackle some of these issues of long-term income security and probably make some money in the process. Saum Seif is founder and CEO of Purpose. He's here to talk about their longevity pension fund. Hello, Saum.
Hey, Bruce. Good to be here.
Did you put my statistics into the mortality table? Because celeries live forever. You do not want me to buy this. I will bankrupt you.
I'm sure. You know what? You're well structured and we've been extremely conservative. And so there's lots of room for the celeries in there.
Okay. I'm glad to hear it. What is the unmet consumer need? Why did you decide to launch this thing?
Well, look, I think you actually explained it quite well at the beginning, which is we've got two really important problems. People are demographically turning 65, more and more Canadians every single day. Over 1,000 Canadians turn 65. I don't know if people actually know that statistics, but it's pretty daunting when you look at it that way. Turn 65 every single day. And second is, people are living longer. Life expectancy is increasing. It's been continuously increasing. And, so the challenge is that most people would get into retirement where they have to solve their income needs by themselves. At that stage, and most people would think, oh, I've got 5 or 10 more years. But reality is most people are living on average, another 13 to 15 years. And that's extending. So not only you're solving for, your income needs, but you're also having it with an imperfect set of information. Mm. While at the same time, like the bigger, issue is our industry has kind of retrenched in solving this problem. So as you put it, number of people covered by defined benefit pension plans in their corporate situations has declined substantially. So in the last 30 years, corporations have kind of moved away from doing this. And so it's a really big issue that is not being solved by our industry.
The one product that is out there that isn't the same, but it's in the same neighborhood, perhaps, is an annuity. How does your fund differ from an annuity?
Yeah. So insurance annuities, and as you know, insurance companies underwrite these, and it's the same principle, which is to give certainty of income that matches your life term. The problem, and I'm actually a big fan of the annuity concept. The problem that most people have is that they don't use them. And why? Because, when they're 65, they have to make a decision buy this fund that is irrevocable. So you can't redeem it. You make the decision and you can't, get out of it. And it's a really hard decision for people to use to make. So most people avoid it. My opinion is actually, you know, it should be a part of everyone's retirement plan. And so what we've done is actually take the mechanics that an annuity uses and the same mechanics that that a pension plan is designed with, and effectively, you know, but added the concepts of and the benefits of a mutual fund, which is liquidity and access to your capital, if and so you need it.
So you use, just on your website, you use $100,000 as an example. A retail investor buys this mutual fund for $100,000, buys $100,000 worth of it, and they get $6,150 per year forever.
Forever being the rest of their life. Yes. And that's exactly right. And so the 6.15%, which is for the 65-year-old. And then as age goes up, actually it's increases. So the yield actually gets up to sort of in the sevens, as your age is up. And the really important thing is that's matched to your, life term. So if you live for 10 years or 20 years or 50 years, you're going to receive that income to match it.
You don't guarantee that return. You chose 6.15. Why didn't you choose 5.79456208%? What was the rationale for 6.15? Are you just being cheeky?
No, it's actually it's a great question, and it's really well designed around balancing two things. One, conservativeness. So we, you know, what's really fascinating about this is the way we've designed it, we only need to generate a net return on the portfolio underlying it at about 3.5%. And that was an important to pay out a 6.15% yield for life. And so, and that has to do with the mechanics of sharing and longevity risk pooling and all the rest of it. So we really balanced an attractive yield while also wanting to take very little risk in the portfolio. We could have gone higher, but you know, we felt that you know, that 3.5% was a really attractive return that was very achievable and all the rest of it. Your question on guarantees is a really important one. You know, the point is we've chosen not to have a guarantee for a reason, because actually all the benefit of it not being guaranteed actually means that the investors get all of the upside, not just paying that away. And guarantees are expensive. So the yield would have been lower if we'd guaranteed it. And on top of that is that you wouldn't have had any upside. And in this case, we've actually designed this to have significant income increases over time for investors.
How does that yield change as interest rates change? Or is it a fundamentally different dynamic? Because that's one of the things for, you know, fixed income. Rates are so low these days that the cost benefit on an annuity, for example, it feels out of whack.
Yeah. So first and foremost, it isn't per se going to be focused on interest rates in any short period of time. You know, so it's not sensitive to interest rates. The portfolio we've managed that we're not going to be holding a significant amount of like long duration bonds that have a lot of interest rate risks if rates rise and all the rest of it. But what I will say is that because of that required return on the portfolio, which is very conservative, if rates actually rise, we can actually generate even higher returns. And by doing that, actually we'll be able to increase distributions quite substantially. And so there is a really nice medium to longer term correlation between rates rising and kind of payouts, but it doesn't have an impact on short term.
There are two classes, one for over 65, which it's almost easier for me to imagine, and one for people under 65. Why would somebody be interested in that?
Yeah. So the real innovation here is the decumulation component. So 65 plus. But what we also recognize is that there are lots of people who aren't yet at retirement, but don't have a pension plan. So what we've created is the accumulating class, which is effectively the same thing as a balanced fund. So it's you're getting a well-diversified pension style investment product, and it allows you to accumulate just like any other investment fund. But at the time that, that you turn 65, on the month that you turn 65, it will automatically, on a tax-free basis, roll into the decumulation class. So the beauty of it is it gives you a very fluid, well-structured accumulating vehicle. Well, then tax efficiently will also roll into the decumulation class for you. So kind of it provides the kind of pension plan experience for the masses.
What's the ideal age to purchase it? And you can answer this in two ways. One, what you would tell me and all of my listeners. And then secondly, what you would tell your best friend over a beer in the backyard.
Well, look, I mean, I'll tell you the range of people. So I just bought this for my parents just bought it. They're 72, 73 years old, and it's very well structured for them on the decumulation stage. And anyone 65 plus, it's perfect. It's not really great for like the 77, 78, 78, 9 year old, if you haven't used it already, because there's probably really good annuities out there that you can get at that age. But at the same time, I also have just bought this for myself and my wife at 40 plus years old. And why? Because, you know, it's a great thing that we've created a monthly program. We're going to always have our own little, call it mini pension plan. And when we turn 65, it'll give us a basic income that'll be very nice. And that's a very important thing. So I'm actually a big believer that, you know, this is really designed well for anybody, you know, in the 30s, 40s and 50s, but also, of course, the real rock star thing that we've done here is solve for anyone 65 plus.
Yeah. You have never shied away from having conversations about fees. And it's one of the markers of your leadership in this sector for your career here. I think it's important that we include the fees question. So ETFs are, call it, you know, 0.2%. Average Canadian equity fund is, say, 2.3%. Put this fund into that context.
Yeah. So it's a great question. And look, I'm a big believer that fees matter, but they're not the only thing. So, you know, we've always been really strong around conscious around giving attractive returns and products for attractive fees. So this is actually priced at 0.6%. And that's a really, really attractive fee when you sort of look at it in the context of two things. One is, of course, relative to, you know, mutual funds and costs like that, average balance funds, it's much higher. But the second thing is actually look at it in the context of a large pension plan like CPP or teachers. The CPP's cost to run it is actually over 1%, as most people may or may not know. And so we've actually done something really unique by pricing this extremely well and, you know, write down the balance of what I think is going to provide a great outcome.
Ian McGugin put a few thoughts down in a Globe article, including a quote from Dan Hallett saying, "Someone in the decumulation stage of their life should view investing in this product as effectively a one-way street." Question about flexibility. How do you take that comment?
You know, it's a good question, a good comment, and it's important to understand. So what we've created is an ability to buy this, you know, just like a mutual fund, you can redeem it, you can buy it, you know, now and over time. But at the same time, once you get into decumulations phase, the redemption is different than a traditional fund. And this is what actually is what the secret sauce in this is. You know, by sharing everybody together, what you're creating is you get the access to your unpaid capital, not the net asset value. So if, let's say you put in, you used $100,000, you get $20,000 in distributions, and then you say, hey, I want to redeem because I have a life event. I want to, you know, I have a healthcare issue I want to deal with. Your redemption value is the kind of $100,000 minus the $20,000 you received, so $80,000. What remains in the pool for the benefit of all the other survivors, and that's the same, by the way, if you pass away or if you redeem, it's the same concept, is the all the returns on that money. And so that's what makes this really work, is by sharing the risk and sharing the returns, you effectively make sure that everyone has better access to an income stream for life. But the liquidity flexibility that we provided does have a, you don't get your NAV, you get your unpaid capital. And that's an important point. And that's where I think where Dan's comment was, it doesn't, but go back to the earliest question, which is look at it against an annuity. In an annuity, you don't even have access to the capital. You make that decision. And let's say something changes in 2 years or 5 years, you don't get your money back.
I'm going to ask you to oversimplify a rule of thumb on asset allocation. So when you look at the underlying investments, you've got, you know, equity in there, alternatives, fixed income, whatever. For a retail investor, what percentage of their portfolio should this be, and where, how should they think about it? Is this fixed income given how much equity there is in there? You have 1 minute for my final question.
Yeah, look, so the portfolio is managed like a pension plan. We've taken cues from, you know, we have an investor in OMERS in our portfolio. We have teachers and CPP who we admire. It's managed like a pension plan. That's the key thing. It's all about risk and liability management. In terms of how it fits into a portfolio, it really depends on a basic thing. What is it you're looking to solve for your income needs? The way I look at it as is take your non-discretionary spends, your housing, your medical, your food, your transportation costs, and annuitize them using longevity. And then all the remaining capital could be used for your discretionary spending. And in good years, you can take that trip. You can go spend the money on those gifts. But in bad years, you don't need to draw on that. And that's what this is all about.
Very interesting stuff. Som, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Saum Vissai, founder and CEO of Purpose Investments. He was here to talk about the Longevity Pension Fund.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Some people have been loving working from home, and some people have been hating it. I think it depends in part if you have children underfoot in some ways. But it is clear that our work relationships have not been the same as they were before the pandemic. And we're headed to this emergence phase. There is light at the end of the tunnel, but there is also going to be a hybrid world in which how those relationships continue to be built certainly look different than they did a couple of years ago. So how do you navigate all that? Kimberly B. Cummings is our guest. She is the author of a new book called Next Move, Best Move, Transitioning into a Career You Love. Kimberly, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
There are so many, I love the title of your book. There's so many different ways we could go. I do want to focus, at least at the first point here, on what virtual networking will look like, what it could look like now that this is the way we're going to be for a period of time.
Virtual networking is beyond a hot topic because as I talk to professionals, when COVID hit, they're just like, well, I guess I can't network. We're going to just figure it out when the world opens back up. But now, as we know, it's most likely going to be hybrid. One of the things I tell my clients to do is when you're at a virtual event, when you are out and about in the virtual streets and all the events and new things that are happening, or even at your company, the goal is just to find one connection. That is it. Just find one. And the way that I like to do it is by monitoring the chat and all these virtual events. And I try and pick someone, not a speaker, someone in the chat who is highly interactive. And I follow up, I send them a note, ask them for their LinkedIn and see if we can hop on 15 minutes just to continue the conversation about the event.
And why do you choose someone who's highly active?
Because when you're in that virtual world, let's say an event has, like for my book tour, I have hundreds of people for the event that I have this afternoon. You don't want to pick someone random and just hope for the best. But if someone is already engaging in a conversation, generally that showcases that they're ready to continue the conversation or at least engage in that conversation. If you're engaged, you have something in common.
Every great networking conversation has some give and some get. So you want to get something, like maybe they work at a company you want to work at one day. How do you think about the give? How do you think about balancing that relationship, if not in that first LinkedIn request, then over time?
So my goal is to make sure that I almost forget the get for a little bit. You don't, because the get can make you anxious. That's what makes networking feel so icky to some folks. When it comes to the give, I instruct everyone to ask a lot of questions. People generally like to talk about themselves. So continuously ask questions, go deeper, ask why they do the things they do. Where do they live? How did they get there? Figure out as much about them as possible so you can figure out a give before you start thinking about the get.
I am feeling very proud of myself that just today I was on an event and I sent a LinkedIn message related to, it was actually, this was a panelist, but it was related to what she was talking about. She replied immediately and I feel like she's in my LinkedIn network. Awesome. Yeah. How do you then cultivate that? Because those of us who've been around for a long time, our LinkedIn network can get quite large and you don't want to forget about it because then you're going to need to go to the get and you realize I haven't given any give and now I've got the icky part happening again.
Yeah. So when someone on LinkedIn, like you said, LinkedIn is the worldwide web of professional connections. It's everyone is on there. So I always recommend asking for 15 minutes. And be persistent. Not everyone checks their LinkedIn messages at the same rate as everyone else. I check mine like email, which is daily, sometimes multiple times a day. That's not the case for everyone. So make sure that if you can't interact with their content, if they're posting or publishing on LinkedIn, to kind of make sure your name looks familiar. When you're looking at the message, see if you can follow up a few times if you don't hear back initially. But try to interact with them in a natural way before kind of taking it offline into a conversation.
And then what does that 15 minutes look like? So you and I, you know, we set it up. Here we go. We compliment each other on the great shirts we have chosen for our LinkedIn meeting, which listeners, by the way, she's got an extraordinary yellow top on right now. What does that conversation look like?
Structure your questions. That's the first tip I always give. Don't go in there just expecting a stroke of genius to happen. No, make sure you do your research on the individual. And I always recommend planning at least 3 to 5 key questions that you need answers to that will give you the information to help you figure out what your get could be.
What are some examples of those questions?
So I think the simple one, the low-hanging fruit, is asking them about how they got to where they are. But not just how did you get to where you are, but how did XYZ job help prepare you for this job? What is the most challenging piece of your work every single day? If you weren't doing this right here, what is it that you would be doing? What do you believe is the next step for you in your career? If someone like me were interested in moving into your type of role, what advice would you give me that you wish you had known when you were in a career similar to mine?
I love the question. I'd love being asked for advice. I could spend as much time giving people advice as I could watching Netflix. Yeah. It's like a full-on hobby. I think everybody should just do what I say all the time. That would be delightful.
To make the world better, I'm sure.
Totally. Just do what I say. You have 4 pillars for your network: peers, coaches, mentors, and sponsors. Peers, I get. Like, that's people, you know, we were colleagues in the same cohort early in my career, whatever. Tell me one sentence about the other 3.
Let me break it down. So teachers are the people who can actually teach you something in a safe environment in the workplace. So you don't know how to make a pivot table and you need it for a presentation, you find a teacher who can help you build that skill. Mentors are the folks who've been there, done that, and can give you that tactical day-to-day feedback to help you navigate the world of work. Sponsors are that special sauce. Those are the folks who are in more senior level positions who can pick you up from where you are to bring you to where you'd like to be. Now, people generally ask me next is, can a mentor be a sponsor and sponsor can be a mentor? A sponsor can also be a mentor, but not every mentor can be a sponsor because you really need that senior level power.
Interesting. How do you find the power players in every work environment? How does that work?
Every industry has them. The quickest way that I think about doing it, when you're at work and you propose a new idea, who's the person who has to approve it? Who's the last person who puts that stamp of approval? When you look at conferences and online events, who is that person who's always on stage? Who has the keynote? Who's serving on the panels? You want to find the folks who generally make that final decision or people always want to hear from.
You come to this networking topic with a background in diversity and inclusion.
Yeah.
How does that manifest? How does that alter the process? Because we know, this is empirically, we know that same seeks same. And in order to interrupt some of the power dynamics and the old boys club and all that stuff, we need to be going outside of the sandboxes that we have known. This is for the people at the entering their careers. It is for the mentors and for the sponsors as well. How do we make that happen? How do we make it more than just words?
That is such a heavy question. I think we need 20 more minutes, but
yes.
Let me give you the 2-second answer. So the reason I wrote the book is because I want to put the power back in the hands of the individual. So many times we think about the larger systemic issues, things that are innate to how a culture has been brought. But the book is helping people advocate for themselves and position themselves as leaders in the workplace, regardless of who they are. But from a organization perspective, it's having the conversations that you just asked me right now. It's digging deeper into the microaggressions that happen every day, the bias that happens every single day, figuring out what are specific to those organizations and truly creating an actionable plan and acting it out. I think it's one thing to be slammed in the news about XYZ, but the organizations, more things happen after you donate to Black Lives Matter and Stop Asian Hate. Mm. The actions have to happen after that.
And I think the call to action, I am a white dude. I am mid-career. I have a lot of networks and a lot of relationships. And I take it personally, I have it on my to-do list to ensure that I'm mentoring and supporting people who don't have the same background as I do, who don't look the same as I do. What is the call to action for people like me? Because unfortunately, we're still in the majority. And in order to make systemic change, we got to be doing stuff differently.
So one of those things I call that intersectional allyship. Like, you're looking to really find people who are different with intersectional identities who you can support. So one, I look at the places that you naturally give right now. Where do you give? Where do you give back? Where do you volunteer? What are you interested in? And see how you can begin to diversify those networks and even diversify any problems that you have. How can you get diverse perspectives in your everyday work? We never want someone to kind of create a brand new tour for themselves and kind of champion all these things they've never done before. The first step I always say is looking at your existing network, the existing things that you do every single day, and try to diversify who you're interacting with and get diverse points of view.
Really helpful stuff. Kimberly, thank you for your time today.
You're welcome. Thanks again for having me.
Kimberly B. Cummings is the author of Next Move, Best Move, Transitioning into a Career You'll Love. She joined us from Newark, New Jersey today. And one of the things was on networking in this virtual environment, but also how do we get better as mentors and sponsors of people from backgrounds different than our own? Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, everything you need to know about crypto credit cards. Mikel Castaldo from RateHub.ca will be here. And later, a Canadian fintech called Click2Pay that lets you pay your bills from your bank account using things like a QR code. To stay up to date on all things Moolala, you can sign up for our newsletter. It is free. It is sign upable. Is that a word? Yeah, I made it up. Sign upable at moolala.ca. Newsletter covers all that I've done on CityLine and CBC Radio and BNN Bloomberg and all that. This show too comes once a month, and I'll never do anything with your email address.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. Everyone has heard about cryptocurrency by now. In fact, some of us feel like we've heard just too much about cryptocurrency. But then I hear about this crypto credit card, and I'm like, ugh, I want to talk about that too. MasterCard recently partnered with Gemini Exchange to launch a cryptocurrency rewards card in the US. And here in Canada, there's crypto Visa cards. Like, there's just a lot going on that we need to talk about. Mikel Castaldo from RateHub.ca is here to talk about all we need to know about crypto in the land of credit cards. Hello there.
Hello.
When you say crypto credit cards, what does that actually mean?
That is a brilliant question, because it's not as straightforward as you'd think. So a crypto credit card essentially is a cashback credit card that will let you purchase crypto. So it's not some fancy product that gives you some sort of unique crypto rewards. It's really just a prepaid cashback card that you can use that cash to then purchase crypto. And some of the times it's done automatically. Some of the times you have to actually do the transaction yourself. But that's really all there is to it.
So when you say it's a prepaid card, it's not even a credit card.
Yeah, it's. I mean, if the definition of a credit card is something that has credit, which it should be, then no. A crypto credit card won't help you build your credit. You're not actually borrowing anything. It's really just a card where you prepay a certain amount, and then you're able to get cash back. It's a fancy debit card is maybe a better way to think about it.
And where would someone use this card?
So because it's a lot of them work with major credit card networks like Visa, you could use it as much as you use a normal credit card. There shouldn't be any restrictions on the merchants that accept it as long as that merchant accepts Visa. So really anywhere is the answer.
So a prepaid card with cashback. So historically, we think about a cashback card as giving around, you know, say 2% of our total purchases back to us in cash. You're saying that we get the equivalent of that 2% or so, but instead of it coming to us in cash, it comes to us in crypto?
You would think, but that's not how it works. So for the current iteration of crypto cards that are in the market, and caveat is, this is today, snapshot in time in Canada, it can change. The way it works is you get, let's say, 1% cash back. That cash,
literally cash, like Canadian dollars cash back.
Canadian dollars. That is then deposited into your crypto account. And then in that crypto account, you can go ahead and purchase crypto. So the goal of it is to get your feet wet in terms of crypto investing, and it makes the process more seamless if the way you like to operate is in crypto more than in Canadian dollars. But you don't actually get crypto cash back because the logistics of it would be quite complicated. Yeah. You have to open a new crypto wallet. So this is the way they do it to keep it simple.
So is it, I love how we're spending like 4 hours just on the definition of it. Is it as simple as they're taking a Coinbase digital wallet and putting it right alongside the card so that the cashback just goes immediately into that Coinbase wallet equivalent?
That is exactly how it works.
Okay. I'm a genius. I finally figured it out. Now, I talked off the top about MasterCard and Visa, and there's a bunch of stuff, and some of it's US, some of it's in Canada. Where is Canada in terms of embracing these prepaid cashback cards compared to where other markets around the world are? So we have some things. Are we leading the pack or are we lagging?
If I had to make a call one way or the other, I'd say that we're lagging. But that's lagging behind the States. So I can talk about how what the landscape looks like in Canada and how that compares to the States. So
yeah, please do.
Yes, some of the major cards you'll see in Canada are the crypto.com Visa, the Mogo prepaid Visa, local coin prepaid Visa. And the way that these cards work is the way that I just described, where you actually get the cash back benefits in cash, and then you use that to buy crypto. Now in the States, there's been talk about cards where you're not actually getting cash back in dollars, but you get cash back directly in crypto. So I think there's nothing 100% confirmed, at least to my knowledge, but the innovation is happening in the States. With this kind of stuff, Canada's likely to come on as a close second, just because there's a lot more brains working on the problem down south.
How close are, I guess, probably fintechs or payments providers in the US to creating a product that will allow you to actually transact in crypto with the Visa brand slapped on the card?
That's a great question. Just because nothing has been publicly shared, at least to my knowledge, it's hard to say. But I think because there's been rumors around them releasing cards where you actually get the cash back in crypto, then it's possible that it's closer than we think. The challenge is there's a whole issue around regulation when it comes down to if you're actually able to transact in crypto. So I think part of the barrier that these providers are seeing to innovating and to getting to a real crypto credit card is the fact that it's not necessarily legal tender everywhere. So especially when there's banks that want to err more cautiously, you're going to see regulation being a large driver of the direction that innovation takes in the market.
How big an idea do you think this is? Because based on how took us, as I say, 4 hours to actually define it for people, but also the dollars involved aren't going to be that significant unless you're popping, you know, 10 grand on your card every single month. It's not a huge amount of money. It seems like a fair amount of work for not a huge amount of money.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'll be honest. I think the way that the cards are structured right now, you have to be a real crypto enthusiast to want to use some of them. Or in the case of, let's say, like the Mogo prepaid card, there's a host of other benefits that come with it. But you won't see me rushing to go and get one of these cards today. And I'm on the more bullish side of the crypto spectrum. And it's just the product innovation isn't where it needs to be yet.
Now, what would you say about the prepaid component of that? So a traditional credit card with Visa, if it's a high-end one, it's going to have some sort of a fee and that gets you some bling. If it's a lower rate card, there might not be a fee, but they're going to make some money off the spread for based on those clients who don't pay in full. That's how they make their money there. With prepaid cards, what are the fees involved? How much does the consumer pay for that privilege?
So it really depends on the card. So there's certain prepaid cards that are no fee. Usually you're going to see like a fee ranging somewhere between $10 and $15 a month. And then on top of that, you actually have to go and load a minimum amount onto your card. So it's hard to make a call one way or the other. I think the average I've seen is about $10 per month. But really what you're going to have to do is go and read the fine print on your prepaid card and see what the actual fee falls to there.
This is a 30,000 feet question. What is in it for brands like Visa, MasterCard, even PayPal to energize this move towards cryptocurrency? Don't they stand to lose over time if we shift away from traditional currencies backed by central banks?
That's a fascinating question, Bruce. I think let me tackle it first from the perspective of some of these crypto providers, and then we can talk about Visa. So some of the providers that are offering these prepaid cards, it's a super attractive proposal to them from a business perspective because customer loyalty for a lot of these crypto exchanges is a difficult thing. But if suddenly you're using a card that automatically deposits cash into this particular crypto exchange and you're getting used to using that exchange, then it makes a ton of business sense for people operating these exchanges because it's a stickiness driver and it's going to make you a more loyal customer. For someone like Visa, I mean, I don't want to make a comment on their behalf because they're such large organizations and it's hard to tell who's approving it at what level and what's in it for them. But I know that as like the payment landscape is advancing, Visa, MasterCard are looking to see how they can innovate, especially as we're seeing a lot of regulatory pressure to lower some of the fees, especially on the merchant side. So I think some of it can be a bet towards the future to counteract some of that downward pressure on merchant fees. But it's hard to say the incentive is a lot clearer. Let's put it this way. The incentive is a lot clearer as to why a crypto exchange would want to start a crypto card than why Visa would want to underwrite it, other than it's just normal business for them.
Right. Very interesting, Mikhail. Thank you for your time today.
Happy to be here.
Mikhail Castaldo is with RateHub.ca. He was here to talk about some of these crypto credit cards out there, and it's kind of a simpler idea and more complicated in the very same breath.
Hi, it's me, your dad. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Stay with us. Coming up later, we're going to talk to Michael Bradley. He is CEO and founder of Click to Pay, which is a new Canadian fintech that lets you pay your bills and your invoices directly from your bank account in, among other ways, using a QR code. Now, if you have missed an episode of Moolala, I can't believe it if you have, but if you have, you can go get caught up in a couple of different ways. One, you can go to your podcast provider, Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Music, Amazon Prime, wherever you get your podcasts and download the full show. You can also go to moolala.ca, and we've got a pretty cool search function there that allows you to search by topic or guest or whatever. While you're on the podcast platform, though, make a note, subscribe to it, then it'll just arrive on your device without you doing a thing.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
No matter what your financial situation is, how can you create a life of abundance by changing your relationship with money? This is the question that's explored in Ken Honda's book, Happy Money, The Japanese Art of Making Peace with Your Money. He joins us now from Tokyo, Japan, to talk more about the book and how you can choose Happy money. Hello there, and thank you for getting up at 4 a.m. to talk to us. We appreciate
it. Hello, Bruce. Hey, hi, this is Ken Honda. I just woke up early, and I'm so excited. This is a beautiful way of starting my day in Tokyo.
Fantastic. Now, you begin the book with this amazing story about someone looking through your wallet, and they were looking to see if your money was smiling. What does that even mean? How could she tell? And what was the answer?
I was at the party in Tokyo, and she approached me. At the time, you know, magazine article, they were focusing on what kinds of wallets celebrities do have. You know, wouldn't that be interesting to see what Justin Bieber and all those celebrities, you know, do they even have a wallet? So, okay. And I told her, as long as you give it back to me, you can take a look at my wallet. And she pulled out all the bills and she was checking something. And she was saying, this is okay. This is great. This is wonderful. And she put back all the bills and gave it back to me. And I asked her, what are you doing? And she said, I was checking if I could see you're okay. And Ken, you're good to go. And I asked her, am I good to go? It sounds good. But what is it? She said, you must have made a lot of people smile and happy. That's why all the bills in your wallet are smiling. And I still didn't get it. And she said, I'm psychic and I see things that other people don't see. And she says, if you are making people happy and receive money, your money is smiling in your wallet. And if you're taking advantage of other people or do the work that you don't like and get money, your money is crying or getting upset in your wallet. And I thought it's interesting. And I started to wonder what kinds of money is in my friend's wallet. And I had so much fun thinking, even thinking about it. That's the story goes.
Wow. I can imagine some of our listeners are like, that is a little too woo-woo for
yes,
me.
Yes.
But it's it's an amazing part of your journey, and your book is fascinating. You use a phrase called happy money. How do you define that phrase, and what are some examples of it?
Happy money makes you smile when you receive it. When you make money, you just receive money from your clients and companies. And if you can smile with the money, that's happy money. And also on the other end, when you spend money, and if you just feel joy and makes you happy, that's also happy money. So when you write checks and pay bills and still keep smiling, that's happy money. Happy money doesn't really matter if you have so much or so little, because it's your relationship with money. I've met and I have interviewed many millionaires and billionaires in my career as an author. I have found many unhappy ones. And at the same time, among those who are struggling financially, I found some who are doing well emotionally because they receive money with happiness and also spend money with happiness.
Ken, thank you so much for joining us and for providing your insight. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Bruce. You've asked the best questions ever, and
Excellent.
I really enjoyed being interviewed.
Excellent.
I'm so honored. I feel so honored, and thank you. This is a great way of starting my day.
Thank you so much. Ken Honda's book is called Happy Money, The Japanese Art of Making Peace with Your Money. He joined us very, very early from Tokyo, Japan. Coming up next, we'll talk to Michael Bradley, the CEO and founder of Click to Pay, about a new service that he says is focused on people who want more control when it comes to their bill payments. And we'd love to hear from you. We'd love to have you give us your thoughts and questions and control about this show. ask@moolala.ca is our email address. ask@moolala.ca.
Thank you. You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
No one likes paying their bills. I mean, it reminds you of the money that you spend. Logistically, it's annoying, but maybe there's an easier, more seamless way to do it. That may be where Click to Pay comes in. So it allows users to pay bills directly from their bank account using text, email, or even a QR code. How cool is that? Michael Bradley is the CEO and founder of Click to Pay, and he joins us now. Michael, what is the idea here? What are you trying to do?
Great. Well, Bruce, I think you described it pretty well. For the longest time in Canada, we've had the ability to be able to pay bills. You know, you get your bill in, and if you're anything like me, you take the, if you're still getting a paper bill, you take your cell phone, log into your bank, find your biller, select your account, make the payment. Today, using Click to Pay and Interac e-transfer, we make it much easier for the customer. So whether you're getting a digital bill in email, or whether you get a text message with the notice that your bill is due, we allow you to pay straight from the message that you get from the biller.
And how does it actually work? I mean, explain it to me like I'm a six-year-old, but I still want to understand how it works.
Of course. Yeah, it sounds a bit like magic. And that is actually the magic of Click to Pay and Interac e-transfer. So what we do is we pre-program the amount of the bill within the Interac request money service. So if you've used Interac e-transfer, you're probably used to being able to settle up a bill, say the two of us had a dinner, settling up a hockey pool bet. That seems apt for this time of year that you send money. You also, there's a function called Interac request money, which allows me to be able to nudge you for that obligation that you owe. And we're using that feature in order to be able to pre-program these transactions. So kind of long story short, you know, what we've done is we've created the transaction within Interac and connected it to a link. So when you get your digital bill or you get your text message, that it's right there for you, already registered.
How much does it cost the consumer? How much would this cost me?
The short answer is nothing over and above what you're already paying your bank for transaction fees.
Gotcha. Now, is there a human-to-human application for Click to Pay?
Well, yeah, absolutely there is. So in the context of, an overdue bill in a contact center, the ability to be able to use a text message or even communicate, we call it our short code, a 7-letter code, which if you just enter it into our website or the biller's website, takes you to that same pre-registered payment.
So, right. I actually was going down your hockey bet or your dinner analogy, and it would be you owing me. Don't kid yourself. So if you had to pay me money right now, when I go on my bank to do an e-transfer, it costs me, I don't know, like $1.50 or something like that.
Yeah. So if your bank is charging you, most Canadians, I think now are in package plans where they're paying a fixed fee every month and their e-transfers are significantly lower than that. Might be worth shopping around a bit on the account plans. So if you are paying that to your bank, it is like a normal e-transfer transaction.
Because I'm a genius and a personal finance saint, almost every single bill that I have is automated. Does that mean Click to Pay has no relevance to me?
Well, it's up to you. Everyone has different payment preferences, and payments is a game of options. What we like to do is enable people who want to have control over every single bill when they come in to be able to get that bill and pay it just as quickly and conveniently as you can with your pre-authorized card or payment.
Where do these, I mentioned the QR code application. Where would there be a QR code? Is there a QR code on my bill that I've just never noticed before?
Yeah, there certainly could be. And that is the connection point for the QR code. So paper bills, of course, you can't just click a button or click a link on a paper bill, but you can include a QR code. We just demoed on stage a donation for Make-A-Wish Foundation, which came with a $5 kind of pre-programmed QR code. And that function, and people could try Click to Pay by going click2pay.com and doing one of those Make-A-Wish donations.
How do you make your money?
From billers is the short answer. So billers are looking for lower cost, more convenient ways to collect from their customers all the time. And by enabling these communication channels open to customers, our customers who are billers, we have a relationship with them and charge them.
How do you ensure the security of that transaction? People get nuts about security and preferably include at least three words in your answer that illuminate some security jargon that I don't understand.
I'm going to try to keep it a lot simpler than that.
Oh, disappointed.
We build it all on the backs of InterAccy transfer. So the bank security that you enjoy when you sign in, sometimes you'll get with your cell phone the requirement to text a code to you. Sometimes it'll be a secret question that only your bank knows the answer to. All of those security measures are the security measures that are used in order to be able to complete a click-to-pay transaction.
Why doesn't InterAct or a bank just develop and deliver this technology themselves? Why is there even a market opportunity for you?
Yeah, so I wouldn't want to ever speak for InterAct or banks. I think what we're trying to do is offer a competitive product that is convenient for billers, convenient for consumers, and fills a market need.
And you download it as an app?
Not necessary, not even required. Once you get this click-to-pay link, whether it's a button in an email or whether it's a QR code on a paper statement or if it's a text message, you click the button. You go straight over to select your bank and make the payment from your bank account.
Who's your target client? Because I got to tell you, I'm having this conversation with you and I feel like I'm about 97 years old. Like I need to drive my 68 Valiant to the local bank branch of Canada Trust, where I set up the account in the 70s, pull out my passbook and, you know, deposit my pennies. Who's your target market? Not me.
So people who are regular credit card users, of course, aren't going to be too interested in paying from your bank account. We're targeting people who want to pay from their bank account, and certainly over 40% of Canadians prefer to pay bills, especially, you know, day-to-day, month-to-month expenses straight from checking and savings accounts. So we're targeting those customers. And we're also targeting those who want to have control over their invoices. You know, you have a cell phone bill due every month. From my experience, sometimes it's 100, sometimes it could be 250 or 300. Frankly, I'm not sure I want to register that bill against my checking account just so it automatically goes through every month.
You need to check your cell phone plan if you're paying $300 a month. Jeez, there's your helpful tip from me.
Yeah, no comment on my cell phone provider.
Michael, thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much, Bruce.
Michael Bradley is the CEO and founder of Click2Pay. So this is a service that allows you to pay your bills directly from your bank account using text, email, or even one of those groovy QR codes. That is our show for today. Thank you to our sponsor, Credit Canada, this country's first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. If you want to stay up to date on all things Moolala, remember we've got a newsletter. It's once a month. You sign up at moolala.ca. Super easy to do. Also, here's your homework. Subscribe to the podcast version of this show. You can do it at any of the podcast platforms that you visit. On social media, I am at Bruce Celery on Twitter, Bruce Celery Moolala on Facebook. Thank you so much for joining us and have a great day.